Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. There's been a lot of talk about, experiments with family structure in America. That's an issue of ideological and political debate. And it really gets focused on a new book that has just recently been released. The title of it is Raising Boys Without Men. It is by Peggy Drexler, and her argument is likely to get your attention. She suggests that boys are better off being raised by lesbian moms than by a mom and a dad. I'm going to tell you what she has to say, and I just know you're going to want to join this discussion. The phone number 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, a review of issues in the news. At my weblog overnight, I posted an article from New York Magazine. I really went at this because the author, Kurt Anderson, takes on the intelligent design movement, but he does so in a way that just really illustrates the intellectual condescension of the secular left. Now, what he believes is probably quite normal for the elite urban culture of which he is a part in New York City, but the level of condescension and arrogance in this article really ought to have our attention. Mr. Anderson just can't understand why so many modern Americans insist on believing in God. And I'm using his words here. He says, a huge supermajority of Americans believe in, what else to call it, magic. 61% think the world was created in 6 days. 70 to 78% say that hell and the devil and angels exist. 81 to 85% believe in heaven. If opinion polling had existed in the Middle Ages, it's hard to imagine that the numbers would have been much higher, end quote. Well, number one, I don't think he's right about that, but number two, it really does make the point about secular condescension. He says that those of us who believe in such things, that is, in God, heaven, the devil, we're just like throwbacks to the Dark Ages. He and his fellow unbelievers, on the other hand, he says, are, quote, reality-based. Don't you love that? Theirs is a reality base. You're seeing that kind of language more and more. I've seen it in the New York Times. I've heard it on the radio and television conversations. People are saying what we have is a faith-based vision of reality and a reality-based vision of reality. And of course, the condescension in that is just dripping. It just suggests that anyone who believes in God isn't connected to reality. This is one of the most strident, agnostic arguments. I really can't say atheist because he absolutely does not say that he's sure there is no God, but he clearly believes the people who believe in God are out of touch with reality. He says this, and I quote, for practical reasons of both politics and civility, it ordinarily behooves our tiny minority of reality-based infidels to keep quiet about our astonishment that most of our fellow citizens are in thrall to fantastic medieval fever dreams, just as it behooves secular minorities in Islamic countries to keep their modern sentiments to themselves. In countries like ours, the Iraqs and Afghanistans and USAs, liberals need to pick their battles. Now, did you just see the loaded language in that? Did you hear it? Where he talks about the fellow citizens who believe in God being, quote, enthralled to fantastic medieval fever dreams? That's you, ladies and gentlemen, if you believe in God. That's who he's talking about here. But he says that because there are so many God believers and so few, as he says, infidels, that's his word, he says that the liberals, the secularists, have to pick their battles very carefully. But he's decided to pick one. And it's over the issue of intelligent design. He says that if we look back at these months from the future, he warns we're likely to see that theocracy lands in America if the intelligent design theory is allowed to be taught in public school classrooms. This is what he says. Sometimes we have to make an impolitic stink in support of the Enlightenment and of the pieces of the Constitution, like the first words of the Bill of Rights about government making no law respecting an establishment of religion that are its revolutionary political expression. Intelligent design, the hot new rebranding of Christian creationism, is extremely clever, profoundly disingenuous, and I think dangerous. It must be beaten back and kept out of the public schools. Yes, all he needs is a little bit of martial military music behind that, some rolling drums, and perhaps a little bit of Wagnerian opera in order to darken the skies and let everyone know that the culture is about to fall and theocracy is about to arrive because a majority of Americans believe in God. I'm not surprised that somebody believes this, but I every once in a while am still surprised that a major magazine would publish such stuff. He goes on, he says this, according to a new Pew Research Center poll, 64% of Americans are in favor of having creationism and evolution taught in school, and it seems that most of those would actually prefer to replace evolution altogether with scriptural teaching. Like I said, those of us who believe wholeheartedly in science and the First Amendment are the freaks, end quote. Well, evidently quite proud and arrogant freaks, at least at that. They know that they are a minority, but you know what? There's nothing so smug as believing you're in a minority that's right, looking down at all your fellow citizens for their pitiful medieval fever dreams, believing in God. You know, the amazing thing, by the way, just in taking his article apart here, looking at it carefully, is that he talks about those who are the liberals having to make an impolitic stink in support of the Enlightenment, and then he goes on, and listen very carefully, there's an amazing statement here. He says, the pieces of the Constitution, such as the first words of the Bill of Rights about government making no law respecting an establishment of religion, that are its revolutionary political expression. Now, what's interesting there is that he quotes only half of the First Amendment about religion. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution says two things about religion. It says that government may establish no religion. There can be no government establishment. It actually says that Congress may establish no religion. And then it says, or prevent the free exercise thereof. He never gets to the free exercise part. He only likes the no establishment part. What he doesn't like is in America, where you're free to believe in God and actually to believe that there should be public consequences of your belief in God. And then you, yes, listeners, you have the audacity, you with your medieval fever dreams, to believe that you're right to say that your children should not be subjected in the public schools to an unadulterated diet of secularist thought. Packaged in science, of course, as the theory of evolution. Well, every once in a while, it's interesting to know what others think of us, and evidently, Mr. Anderson and those who think like him think that we are medieval throwbacks with our medieval fever dreams, believing in God in our non-reality-based worldview. Well, while we're talking about issues of reality, the reality is that the religious liberties of Americans are being conscribed all over the place, and the Washington Post has a very important article on that. Just today, because the Air Force, which is now facing a lawsuit over alleged proselytizing, has withdrawn a document that permitted chaplains to evangelize military personnel who were not affiliated with any faith. Now, I wrote about this, and we talked about this on the program just a few weeks ago when the Air Force released this document. It was written by the National Conference on Ministry to the Armed Forces. It was a code of ethics, and listen to this. It said, quote, I will not proselytize from other religious bodies, but I retain the right to evangelize those who are not affiliated. Now, a Jewish man filed a suit in federal court in New Mexico claiming, quote, severe, systemic, and pervasive religious discrimination because this policy allows chaplains to seek to evangelize those who are not affiliated with any religion. In this case, Michael L., known as Mickey Weinstein, himself a 1977 Air Force Academy graduate, has accused the Academy's current leaders of fostering pressure on cadets to convert to evangelical Christianity. Now, here's the deal. Whose religious liberties are being violated here? Well, the religious liberties of evangelical chaplains to be evangelical chaplains. Do you understand where this is going? It's like there's giant conformity being demanded now, so that if you want to be a chaplain, you just have to be a religious chaplain. You can't be anything in particular. Well, I guess you can be Jewish, because it would be absolutely politically impossible to argue that you can't be a Jewish chaplain. And I guess you can be a Catholic chaplain. You just can't be an evangelical chaplain if you believe that being an evangelical means actually evangelizing, talking about the evangelical faith, talking about the gospel, seeking to help persons come to know the Lord Jesus Christ as Savior. The existing policy that prompted the lawsuit said that evangelical chaplains could not seek to proselytize persons of other faiths, whether it be Buddhist or Hindu or Catholic or Jewish, or just depending on whatever, that evangelical chaplains could not seek to make converts out of people affiliated with other religious groups. But it said they had the right to share their faith with others. Well, what are they supposed to do now? If the Air Force says they can't do that, then what do they say to someone who comes to them for help? Hi? I'd like to help you, but the Air Force says I can't speak about God, at least not in any branded way. I have to talk about some God in general, a little G God. Now, something tells me that when When someone in the Air Force or at the Air Force Academy comes for help, they're looking for a little more than that. What in the world now can an evangelical chaplain say? Folks are living in one of those times where you can see the pressure cooker of conformity coming down to such a degree that now the whole legitimacy of even the idea of having a chaplaincy is brought into question, because how in the world does an evangelical do anything that's distinctively evangelical if it doesn't mean talking to people about the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ? You talk about religious discrimination. And I would say this is an evidence of cowardice on the part of the Pentagon and the Air Force. They just caved. We'll be back to talk about whether lesbian moms are superior to a mom and dad in raising boys. You're not going to want to miss this discussion. It's hard to believe this book's in print. I'll be right back. Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. I was in a bookstore the other day, a place where I'm frequently found, as a matter of fact, and I saw a book on the new nonfiction table. The title is Raising Boys Without Men. And it immediately caught my attention. It has a close-up picture of a young boy, I'd say maybe 13, 14 years old on the front, and in the background, a mother, a more fuzzy figure. It's rather dramatic. You look at it. The author of the book is Peggy Drexler. She is identified here on the cover as Peggy Drexler, Ph.D., and she's identified on the flyleaf of the book as an assistant professor of psychology in psychiatry at the Weill Medical College of Cornell University. She's also identified, and who knows what this means, as, quote, a former gender scholar at Stanford University, and she's a former board member of New York University's Child Study Center. We're also told that she and her husband of 36 years have two children, ages 12 and 26. I picked up this book because I just had to know, what in the world is this book going to say, Raising Boys Without Men? But the title, the subtitle of the book up at the very top says this, How Maverick Moms Are Creating the Next Generation of Exceptional Men. Well, I just had to read about that. I mean, as you know, I consider the issue of the family, parenting children, to be of utmost importance in terms of Christian accountability and in terms of the future of the civilization. How in the world should we understand something like this? And I picked up the book and I read it. And it was a trip. Peggy Drexler has written this book arguing that boys are better off being raised by women, but not just women, lesbian moms, than by a mom and a dad. She says that boys are better off not having a dad. If they have a dad, they pick up all kinds of bad masculine things. But if they're raised by these maverick lesbian moms, they come out wholesome and relational and happy and all the rest. She says the biggest predictor of success in raising boys is actually not the gender of the parents, but the socioeconomic status of the family unit. There's some amazing stuff in here. You know, there has to be, right? I mean, any book that would have this kind of thesis would have to have all kinds of stuff in it. She suggests that what we need to do is thus to celebrate these new family forms, and in particular, the lesbians who are raising sons on their own. And by the way, they're having them by artificial insemination. She talks in here about some of the boys wanting to know about their, quote, seed dads. The only contribution the dad made was a sperm donation, but they want to know about him because these boys have a hunger for a dad. And that actually comes out in the book. These boys want a father. But Peggy Drexler says that shouldn't concern these moms too much because they also want skateboards. There are all kinds of things boys want they're just not going to have, or they're not going to have now. But just not having a dad, she says, is no big deal. Now, I'm not sure exactly what being a former gender scholar at Cornell University means, or Stanford University means. I'm not sure what all this comes down to in terms of everything about Peggy Drexler's worldview, but in reading this book, I know enough. And it troubles me just to look at this, and of course it's being celebrated out there in the larger culture. You know, you can look at some of the fawning book reviews, and of course there's a lot of media attention to this because this tells people what they want to hear, which is you can redefine the family, you can come up with completely new units, and you can call them families, and you can thus support same-sex marriage and homosexual parenting, and you can do so not only arguing, let's note, that children that are parented in such households can come out all right, or even do equally well as children parented by heterosexual parents. This argument is they actually come out better. Interesting stuff, she says here. Why would they come out better? Well, because fathers tend to push their boys. And fathers tend to imprint on their boys kind of masculinist habits and ways of life. These boys want fathers, but they find better male role models in others, suggests Peggy Drexler. She's done this massive study. That's what this is based upon, is a book. She just narrates all this in terms of what it means. And she comes down to the bottom line, arguing that we should just take a deep breath as a society and basically celebrate the fact that we have these new family structures, and that lesbians are now raising sons, which they've conceived by artificial insemination, and that even as these boys would desire a father and want even to connect to their sperm donor dads, they should recognize that they can find acceptable male role models elsewhere, and then they should live in these basically entirely female-dominated households, and learn more feminine ways of dealing with things. Now, you just have to hear some of this, just in terms of the specifics. Let me read to you from page 78 of the book. She says this: paternal experiences need not be with a live-in father. Grandfathers, godfathers, or their equivalent, uncles, family, friends, coaches, teachers, and caretakers can provide figures for horsing around, mentoring, loving, sharing childhood fantasies, and imparting the business of being a man. The boys who find substitute fathers in the sports world often profit from not having someone who insists that they tough something out. Not having a dad has let Henry off the hook, since he doesn't do well if he's pushed into things, his mother Mary told me. He's blossomed because of the type of coaching he's had. Now, I'll be the first to tell you that when you find a boy without a dad, it makes a huge difference. And for good reason. God intended a boy to have a mother and a father. Now, where there is brokenness in the absence of a father, sometimes it's simply something that couldn't be helped. It can be the result of any number of disruptions or any number of events. But the response to that should be, how should we help? How can we help this mom? How can we help this boy? Not, let's just celebrate the fact that there's no dad, because if there were a dad there, this boy would have the influence of someone who might push him, who might suggest he needed to tough something out. Listen to this. This is one of those things, just a little anecdote that kind of tells you the whole story. Peggy Drexler here is talking on pages 78 and 79 of her book, Raising Boys Without Men. And she's talking about the fact that there is there's one lesbian mother here who has two sons, Sammy and Todd. They play basketball, and one of the boys' ball-playing skills escalated to the point that he was awarded a medal. Sammy was so pleased and proud of his accomplishment that he had a hard time even showing it to his younger brother, Todd. But the lesbian mom reminded Sammy, "You did it, you earned it, but how do you think your brother feels? He doesn't have one. He'd just like to touch it, to feel it around his neck, and he'll give it back to you when he's done." So they worked out a compromise. Little brother Todd could have it for 2 minutes, and the timer was pressed into service. It worked out very well, Tara concluded, with an unmistakable note of satisfaction. Not in real life. I mean, that's just not the way it works. And I don't even believe, actually, it works this way with lesbian moms. And by the way, these lesbian moms can sometimes be quite frustrated and surprised with their boys. One lesbian mom gave her son, who's not allowed to have guns, a hairdryer, and he turned it into a gun. Another little boy simply took his toast in the morning and shaped the toasted bread into a gun and started firing around the kitchen. Folks, it's going to come out. It's going to come out. Boys will be boys. And the reality is the boys need a father, a very strong male role model who lives with them and knows them, who disciplines them and teaches them and plays with them in order to develop into the kind of men they need to be. Peggy Drexler doesn't think so. I want to know what you think. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. What in the world do you say to someone who writes a book that's being celebrated all over the place, suggesting that boys are better off being raised by lesbian mothers than by a mother and a father? You walk into the bookstore these days and you just have to wonder who's reading this stuff. Well, a lot of people, as it turns out, because what is being built here is a body of what is put forth as evidence for why we should accept same-sex marriage, homosexual parenting, and all the rest, and a building sense of cultural inevitability that there's nothing we can do to stop it, and so we might as well celebrate it. The phone number, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're living in strange times, and nothing is perhaps better at reminding us of that fact than looking at a book like this and taking its argument seriously. That's our task. And coast to coast, you're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This book is one of those that almost has to be seen to be believed. It is published by Rodale Press. I need to clarify that not all the parents, or not all the mothers in this book are lesbian, but the majority are. The point she's making is that these maverick moms break all kinds of conventions. And her central focus is on these lesbian couples, two women, and the households they form, even raising boys. And she says, look, you don't have to have a strong male presence in the home, just to have one out there in the community. She says that some of these boys are finding their male role models in cartoons and in animated figures and in literature, and some by coaches and teachers and grandfathers and godfathers and all the rest. But she also goes so far, as I read to you from an excerpt from the book, to argue that, you know, some dads really are the problem. They push their sons. They expect certain masculine behaviors out of their boys. And that's not what these moms want. Let's go to Kurt calling from Tulsa, Oklahoma, listening on XM Satellite Radio. Kurt, what do you make of all this?
Well, I just called in. I thought this is interesting. I'm actually a therapist for a mental health agency. And what I find is something totally opposite. Most of the boys that are being referred to me have problems related to dad either being absent and not being involved in their life, or dad not being in their life at all. And so I'm seeing that they have severe identity confusion. And even when I try to connect them with people in the community, there is nobody that can take the place of that dad that shows them the love, the affection, and the compassion that they would get, you know, from a father figure. And I've seen it. It just doesn't work the same.
Kurt, I really appreciate that insight, especially coming from your own experience. Let me ask you a question here. I mean, we would both admit that there are some dads who come up short. There are some dads who are abusive, and there are far more who are just negligent. But, you know, the reality is that you really can see the positive influence in a boy's life from having a healthy, engaged, loving, and firm father, right?
Yeah, I think, I mean, like I said, there's no comparison. And to do some studies on the other side of the coin, I think you'd have to look at Dr. Ken Canfield's books.
Yeah.
Some of his books on fathering and role models, and the role model that a father should be to his dad. I mean, no dad's perfect. No dad's going to have it all together and have all the skills that it takes to be a perfect father. But I can tell you that if you look at the boys who have a father that is at least involved and loves them unconditionally and spends that time with them, and you look at another boy who's being raised without a father in their life, those boys turn to gangs for a reason, and it's not because they're wanting to identify with females. It's because they're looking for other boys to affirm their masculinity, and no woman's going to be able to do that. There's only certain things that they can get from a man, and they're not going to find it just in a coach or in something else, because that person has boundaries, and they cannot cross those boundaries to give that child the love and affection that they really need.
Kurt, I should have had you scheduled for an interview. That was fantastic, and I really do appreciate the articulate expertise and insight that you bring to this, and I think that's what most people intuitively know. It's what they observe, and I have to tell you, as an educator that works with an awful lot of young men, I can generally tell you the guys that had a dad and those that didn't. Or when I say had a dad, I mean not only biologically and even not only in the home, but I mean a dad who really mattered and a dad who was there. But, you know, this argument that lesbian moms can do a better job of raising boys than a household with a mom and a dad, you know, my guess is that the vast majority of Americans aren't going to buy this for a minute. But I just have to believe that the audience that would be the hardest sell on this would be boys. You know, I just don't believe that they're going to come up with a kind of moral relativism and cultural relativism that Peggy Drexler and the moms that she interviewed are looking for. You know, I talk to young men all the time whose great vacuum in their lives is the absence of a father. Even in their 20s, even in their young manhood, they're still trying to figure out something of who they are, because they never had a dad to really imprint upon them what it means to be a man, to validate them, to give them the attention and the influence that they need. And really to say this in the clearest way that only a dad can really say, which is, You're doing fine. You are a man. You are masculine. And you need to do better. And I'm going to push you to do better. And I'm not going to let you rest without doing better because I'm your dad. Folks, again, where there isn't a dad, the obvious answer is how we can help that family, help that mom, help that boy. This isn't criticism of moms who find themselves without a dad at the present. You know, we could talk about that in a different program. The issue right now is, what do you do? And I would suggest the worst thing you can do is celebrate the absence of a father. The phone number, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program. Folks, let me invite you to a little thought experiment with me on pages, 29 and following of this book, Raising Boys Without Men. Peggy Drexler writes this. She says, boys raised in mother-only families were remarkably resourceful in securing role models for their masculinity. They searched out teachers, friends of the family, coaches, and neighbors. If the boys were having trouble finding these men, their mothers stepped in to help. Oh, let me just insert here. I'm sure that was greatly appreciated. Most of the boys were fascinated by sports figures, and they had precocious knowledge of the details of the lives of their heroes. They were especially intrigued by the lives of two-generation athletes, taking special pleasure in following those father-son duos. Since the boys themselves had a big say in the choice of males they admired, they were able to select men whose interests and personalities were in harmony with their own. They gave short shrift to those who were unkind or authoritarian, whether blood relatives or not. The range of choices, the ways in which mothers helped, and the ingenuity of these boys, well, she deals with that in a different chapter. You know, here's the thought experiment. What if you reverse the whole equation? What if you take this out and you write the book on raising girls without women? What if you suggest that it really isn't important to have a woman in the household, that two gay men could do just as good a job of raising a girl as a heterosexual set of parents, mother and a father, and that these girls could simply then choose the female role models they wanted, and that they could then, without a woman in the home, just develop what kind of female identity they wanted. You know, the feminists, I guarantee you, would be up in arms. But it's safe to go after the men. It's safe to suggest that boys don't need fathers. And it's safe here to talk about it. Let's go to Scott calling from Medina, Ohio, listening on WHKW. Scott, welcome.
Hi there. I just had one point I wanted to get your take on. Basically, I consider the book kind of, you know, it's way out there. It's kind of on the fringe of what I would consider to even be a reality at all. But when you read the author's resume, it was on some mainstream colleges and universities. And I think that really is an indictment of our higher education system. And I think parents need to be aware when they're writing that check out to the university, what kind of people those universities hire to educate their children. It's a scary thing to me. What's your thought on that?
Scott, that is a great angle on this. Yeah, I mean, after all, her address is a university. It's Cornell University. And it formerly was Stanford University. And before that, it was New York University's Child Study Center. You're exactly right. What parents are paying for in a lot of these elite institutions is high tuition for their children to be taught this kind of stuff from the people that write books just like this. Let me give you another angle on this. On the back of the book, there is a list of blurbs, of endorsements. The first one's by Judith Wallerstein. She's a very well-known and well-regarded family scholar that has done a tremendous study of the impact of divorce. Then you have Richard North Patterson, a best-selling novelist. And then Anthony Lewis, former columnist for the New York Times. They all like the book. And, well, it just goes on and on. In other words, it is cool and sophisticated out there in the larger secular culture to applaud this kind of book as giving us good news. Now, I have to tell you, one of the things that really bothers me about this book are the sweeping generalizations. You know, she uses two forms of expression in this book that really are excellent ways to communicate. They just are completely without documentation. One is the personal anecdote. Well, this boy turned out fine. Here's his story with his mom or moms. And the other thing is these sweeping generalizations that you get all the time confronted with. They get picked up in the news. They get thrown around in public debate. But, you know, just because she says it, of course, just doesn't make it so. Let's go to Glenn calling from Tampa, Florida, listening on WTBN. Glenn, what's your make on all this?
unbelievable. Unbelievable that someone can actually write a book like this that and is of such a high education. Did you interview anybody that actually grew up without a father? I'm a 31-year-old man that's been married for almost 3 years, trying my best to learn how to raise a family because I didn't have a role model like that. Every day, my wife and I were just talking about it the other day, how difficult it is because I've never seen it done correctly, and how only because of Jesus in my life am I where I am right now with my family. You can't do that. I mean, my blood is boiling just at the thought of. The more you talk about it, the more it just makes me want to go. I mean, it's just unbiblical. It's totally wrong, and it really offends me as a 31-year-old male that didn't have a father in his life. It's terrible.
Well, Glenn, there you go, being male again. I mean, getting up in arms about this and wanting to do something about it. God bless you. And thank you. Thank you for that personal word. I think that really helps us to focus on the real life story here. And I have to tell you, Glenn, I think an awful lot of the boys who are interviewed in this book are likely later on in life to give precisely the same kind of response that you've just given. Glenn, let me ask you, are you a part of a good gospel biblical church?
Yes.
You know, I would just suggest to you, and I can just tell you, I am thankful, not only the fact that you called, I'm thankful that you are where you are in life right now, because you can really help a lot of people, even in your church, to understand exactly what we're talking about here. And I hope that as you talk about your difficulty, let me tell you, your heart inclined towards pleasing the Lord as a father is one of the most encouraging things I have heard. And as you seek, to figure out what all that means as you raise your own children, hopefully you're surrounded, even in your church, by some other faithful fathers. And I hope you're trying to figure this out together. That is a part of the glory of the local church. We encourage each other, teach each other, and sometimes even admonish and correct each other as we learn together how to fulfill all the responsibilities God has given us in a way that will bring God the greatest glory. Glenn, you made my day with that call. Go right ahead.
Thank you. Well, I was going to say it's a biblical thing, too, because even now, I see myself with people in church, with men, and I don't mean in any kind of weird sexual way, but trying to bond with other men because of things I never learned in life, mechanics, working on a cause, whatever it may be, that I see myself drawn to these other people because I never had it.
Yeah.
Because I've never experienced it. And I'm talking just construction stuff, just doing these different things that a kid grows up doing as a man because of his father. I have never got a chance to experience that. And it's really hard for me now, because I've got two boys now myself, and trying to make sure that they're, trying to balance out, not being too strict and not being strict enough, and trying to balance out only because the only thing I've ever learned is from a single mother,
Yeah.
And it's just a struggle, and it really affects me to hear that someone with that has a family with she's a wife and a husband and has two boys of her own would think that two women could possibly do the job that God set out for a man and a woman to do together.
Glenn, eloquent. Thank you. And very powerful. There's nothing like a first-person testimony to get right down to it. And Glenn's first-person testimony saturated with the gospel. Because he's talking about what Christ has done in his life. I am thankful he's in a local church where I hope all these things come together. And I'm thankful God's given him two boys, because I think he's going to have the joy that was denied himself as a son in being a father to these two boys. Folks, I knew this would get a conversation going, and it should. And when you look at a book like this, it's just another reminder that the world is out there looking in all kinds of directions, mired in all kinds of confusions. We're the people who are supposed to bring clarity. I'll be right back with some final thoughts. I'm Albert Mohler. Well, folks, welcome back. The board's lit up, and an awful lot of people wanted to talk about this. This is going to be an ongoing kind of concern, because what we see here is really just the beginning of what I see as a likely avalanche of this kind of research and study and book and talk show cycle, where you're going to have people writing books like this and arguing on behalf of these alternative family forms and saying everything's just fine. I think we're just seeing a hint of what is to come. Very quickly, let's go to Catherine calling from Clearwater, Florida, listening on WTBN. Catherine, it's your turn.
I think these lesbian women are trying to psychologically emasculate their sons. What's wrong with a man having manly qualities?
Well, let me just hold with me here for Catherine just for a minute. You say that it's all right then. It may be even necessary then for some of these dads to push their sons.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but in the real life work world and everything, there is, you know, a toughness. And, you know, welcome to the real world. Try to go out in the workforce.
Okay, I'm with you, Catherine. You're talking to the converted, you know, absolutely. And I think that, you know, that raises another very good point. You know, what does it mean to look at these boys when they're 9, 10, 11, 12 and say they're doing fine? Well, you know, those kids have an awful lot of resilience. Those little boys, they haven't faced a lot of the tests of adulthood yet. In fact, almost none. They haven't faced the tests of adolescence, not most of them. And let me tell you, adolescence is brutal. And it's brutal, I'm sure, in the female experience as well as the male experience. And one of the things an adolescent boy desperately needs is a dad to watch him, to protect him, to give him boundaries, and also to validate him. Because, you know, the questions of adolescence are the questions of self-identity. They come around again and again and again. Where's this boy going to look for the ratification, the validation of who he is? Well, you know, what we really heard earlier was that, well, from Kurt, you know, if they don't get that kind of validation at home from dad, they're going to look for it elsewhere. And it just may be, well, not the kind of positive source that Peggy Drexler says these boys are finding, but a negative source. Kurt mentioned the gangs. And, you know, eloquently, he said, look, they're not looking for female validation, the young people who are joining these gangs. The same thing's true just in terms of the boy culture that you find just in your average suburban American high school. And, you know, what's going on the sports field and what's going on in the locker room and what's going on in the halls and in the classroom and in the cars and just about everywhere is boys trying to figure out what it means to be men. And if there aren't real men there, and I really hope and pray a lot of Christian men there, then what they're going to get is a warped idea of masculinity. And let's just wonder if those who are pushing this kind of agenda, the feminists and those who are pushing for these alternative family forms, you know, I fear that the worst thing they could possibly get is exactly what they're asking for. Once they have it, I don't think they're going to like it. And we're the people who know why, because the glory of God is in getting it right, because we understand the family as God's creation, and the roles of men and women as God ordained, and the necessity of mothers and fathers as God's perfect plan. We'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.